Hello and welcome to Relief, a show about art and faith. I'm Dan Bowman and I'm here with my co-host Amy Peterson.
Hi guys.
Relief is a show where we talk with writers and people of faith about life and art and the relationship between art and faith, the writing process, the questions and the passions that drive us to create. This week, Amy spoke with author Marilyn Chandler McIntyre. Some of you may be familiar with her work. And how did that conversation go?
It was so great. Marilyn was in town here to speak at a student leadership conference. So I caught up with her after one of her sessions, and we just talked about all kinds of things. She has a really fascinating range of experiences.
Yeah. For those of you who aren't familiar with Marilyn's work, she's a writer and a professor of medical humanities at Berkeley, and she also taught at Westmont College for a number of years. I know her best for her book, Caring for Words in a Culture of Lies, which if you haven't read that, you should check that out really soon. What many people don't know is that she's a poet as well as a scholar, and she's published several volumes of ekphrastic poetry, reflecting on paintings by Van Gogh and Vermeer and Rembrandt.
Yeah, and we actually got her to read a couple of those poems in our interview, so that was really fun. We also talked about her work in the medical humanities, which is a field I was not very familiar with, but she talks a little bit about what the arts have to do with illness and end-of-life conversations, and those are also topics that are at the heart of her two most recent books, A Long Letting Go and A Faithful Farewell. And I had to ask her just what her secret is, because this woman is so prolific and she's so accomplished in a lot of fields.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I can't wait to hear what that secret is. But before we listen to the interview, I just want to remind listeners to check out the website. It's reliefjournal.com, and you'll find thoughtful essays. We have a terrific blog with writers around the country. We post about three times a week. And also connect with us on social media, on Twitter, Facebook. You'll find the Relief Print Journal and some other great stuff. We'd love to hear from you.
And if you enjoy this podcast, please be sure to click subscribe in iTunes so you won't miss an episode.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, without further ado, here's Amy with Marilyn Chandler McIntyre.
Marilyn, thank you so much for taking time to be with us this morning.
I
guess
pleasure.
You are probably known most of all for your book, Caring for Words in a Culture of Lies. And as I was researching for this interview, I found that you've actually published quite a few books, academic books, works of poetry, as well as spiritual nonfiction. And you've also been a professor for many years, and you've parented six children. And so as I read through that, I guess the first question that came to mind was, how did you do all of those things and do them so well? Do you have any advice for those of us who are trying to balance so many kinds of things?
The term that comes to mind is ad hoc. You do what's in front of you, right, on any given day.
Yeah.
And a phrase that a mentor taught me many years ago has served me so well. She said, you tend to think of calling in these large terms. You think about life and your career. She said, think about the call of the moment and the movement of the spirit in the day. And like my friend I referred to in the talk, who looks at a situation and says, what's that about? To see what's in front of you and say, what's that about? Is this of God, as the Quakers ask? What does the moment call for? What do I need to lay aside in order to be attentive? When do I need to say no in order to attend to something that is on the agenda? That's an ongoing challenge. And I certainly don't have any definitive answers for it, as my husband would attest. But we do get up early every day and check in. We light a candle. We tell each other our dreams. We talk about the day. We read the lectionary. That helps. We spend some quiet time. And then it just helps me to focus on the day. The day is what we have. And so it's not that there isn't time for planning or considering it all, but I have to say that when I look at the to-do list, I go into overwhelm immediately. But accepting the challenge every day of sorting and sifting and coming back to center has been an important practice. And tennis helped with that, too. I used to play tennis. I hurt my shoulder, so I don't play anymore. But what tennis taught me was forgive yourself immediately and come back to the center. Mm-hmm. You know how you come back to center court to be ready for the next shot.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great metaphor.
It is. Well, a lot of our listeners are writers or people who are hoping to publish. And so I always like to ask kind of how you got started in your journey as a writer. It looks like some of the first books you published were books of poetry. Is that right?
No, actually, my first book was a warmed over dissertation, as so
okay.
many are.
Yeah. And
that
what was that?
That was a book called A Healing Art, Regeneration Through Autobiography.
Hmm.
And it was really fun to write. I was looking at the narrative experiments of writers who are coming out of massive life crisis. First World War, Second World War, psychotic breakdown, profound losses, and begin their stories with, there's no way to tell this,
mm-hmm.
Holocaust memoirs. And then they find ways to tell it. So moving from, this is beyond language, this is beyond articulation, to finding a form and finding sentences in which to tell it, was a process that really fascinated me.
What drew you to that kind of writer, a writer who has undergone such a trauma?
I think that it was the same thing that led me to medical humanities. I think my mother's stories of doing medical work on the mission field were very early formative influences for me, and medicine was always a road not taken, but I think the whole business of healing has informed my life as a teacher, because I think teaching and healing are very similar enterprises. You're really trying to restore or nourish life, help someone to flourish in both professions. And I had a very articulate family. I grew up in a 3-generation household. My grandmother, who had been poor most of her life, but certainly had that aura of a Virginia lady. And my grandfather from North Carolina would tell stories at the dinner table. And so I always was encouraged to listen longer than I suspect most children tend to want to listen, and to respect language. And I would get this kind of gentle, good-humored correction from both my parents and grandparents when I was speaking carelessly. So they always encouraged me to write. English teachers encouraged me to write. So, you know, I came by it the way most people do, which is, I think you're a writer, right?
Yeah.
And it's a pleasure. I don't think we can overlook fun. I think that if you're, Germaine Greer says, if the struggle is not joyous, it's the wrong struggle. And I like that line. Because it's not that if you love to write, writing isn't still a little daunting some days. And honestly, after, I don't know, 11 or 12 books, I still have days when I sit down with a new Word document on the screen thinking, I don't think I know how to do this.
Yeah.
But it's been the place where I feel like I'm in the joyous struggle. And
yeah.
It blesses me when I do it. And I feel thankful.
Mm-hmm. So that first book, who published that?
That was Garland Press. It's a press that publishes a lot of academic things. And then it was republished by Routledge.
Okay. And at that point, you were already teaching?
Yes.
Yeah.
I taught at Mills College for 10 years.
I'm kind of going back a bit, but as you described, those writers who had been through something unspeakable said there was no words for it and then found words for it. A word came to my mind, and I'm not sure if it's the right word, so we can edit this out later if it's not, but apophatic, is that the right word?
Yes.
Yes? Talk a little bit about that word.
The negative way, the via negativa.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's the cataphatic and the apophatic traditions, and that is a kind of spirituality of plenitude and a spirituality of absence. And so, yes, these are people who have been driven into their own dark night, although to appropriate that term is a little inappropriate when people are incarcerated or, you know, kept in a concentration camp. That's not the same as St. John of the Cross's dark night of the soul.
Right.
But still, people who have gone to the abyss
mm-hmm.
and lived in the darkness and survived come back with a huge challenge, trying to find ways to use stories to connect. And I'll give you an example of that. I had a wonderful professor at Princeton who was a Holocaust survivor. She'd spent her entire childhood in the Viennese ghetto and then in Theresienstadt and then in Auschwitz. And 2 months before the liberation, she escaped with her mother and another woman, and they lived in the woods in the winter for 2 months, finally found their way to a village mm-hmm. and eventually came to the States. But she said, she was talking one time about the process of adapting to ordinary life and ordinary culture, and that was a long process of filtering what she had to tell, because other people just naturally at a dinner table tell stories from their childhood. She said, one time we were at a dinner party and people started talking about claustrophobia and the experience of claustrophobia, and they were giving examples of being locked in elevators. And she said, I realized that if I told about being in a cattle car with people who had to pee on the floor and no ventilation, it would completely stop the conversation. So there are things I can't tell,
mm-hmm.
not because I'm unwilling or even unable, but they don't fit anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a not uncommon experience, even for people who have been through illness. I read a lot of illness narratives now. And Flannery O'Connor says, illness is a country you go to and nobody can follow you there,
mm-hmm.
something like that. So there's something you just either have to make a great effort to translate for people or you keep it to yourself.
Mm. So you mentioned the illness narratives you've been reading, and that's because of your new position at Berkeley, right?
Right.
How long have you been there?
Well, this is my seventh year.
Seventh year, okay.
And I'm in a part-time position. I gave up full-time undergraduate teaching when I left Westmont.
Okay.
But I love working with the med students.
So tell me more about the medical humanities. That's not something I'm familiar with, but it sounds like something we need.
Yes, and it's been an emergent field since about the early 1980s. A man named George Rousseau was one of the people who started it, another man at UT Austin. It's an effort to restore reflection on cultural dimensions of medicine and language and story, medical history, to medical education, which has gotten so dominated by the pharmaceutical industry, for one
mm-hmm.
thing, and also by kind of technological approach to medicine, by the privatization of hospitals, by the culture of hurry and momentum that requires that doctors spend less and less time with patients. So medical humanities is a pushback. And the way I got to it was that I've always been interested in people's illness narratives and stories about how people cope. I was fascinated with biography when I was a kid, and I realized at some point that the appeal of biography is just to satisfy the curiosity about how other people do this. We all get put on a planet. We get different assignments. Some of us get difficult bodies.
Mm-hmm.
How do people cope?
Mm-hmm.
So I was living in Oakland at the time of the AIDS crisis, when it really crested in the mid-1980s. And I went over to San Francisco to the Castro District, which is a sort of center of gay and lesbian culture, and there's a big bookstore there called In a Different Light. And I just browsed through shelves of memoirs, drama, poetry, fiction, nonfiction, about AIDS, and thought, this is a huge kind of subgenre unto itself at this point. People are writing about this. So I wrote a piece for the MLA about the literature of AIDS and went to this MLA meeting and found that there were other people doing what I was doing. So I was thrilled and eventually joined the board of the journal Literature and Medicine, and also the board of a online database of literature, arts, and medicine, which is still very functional and I think widely used by support groups and physicians and caregivers. Hmm. But it's an effort to help people reflect on issues like how we are acculturated to think about the body-mind-spirit relationship, for instance, or what language we bring to the medical transaction or encounter. American medicine is riddled with language of aggression and military language about fighting mm-hmm. cancer and bombarding things with antibiotics and taking aggressive approaches. And it's really unfortunate that that's become such a dominant metaphor, but it's not a surprise in this culture because the military dominates the budget too, right? So just to make people aware of even listening for the metaphors that patients come up with or the ways they put things, I think is a real ministry to those who are becoming doctors and to their patients. And I maintain, I really believe, that a practice of reading poetry or reading anything thoughtfully together makes them better clinicians. And of course, I get the ones who self-select into the class. It's not required, so they are people who are motivated to be open-hearted, compassionate physicians who treat the whole patient, not just the disease.
So do you brainstorm better metaphors to use?
We do.
Yeah.
And I tell them a story that appears at the beginning of a book a friend wrote called Reconstructing Illness about a young man who's a Quaker who got cancer. He'd been a Quaker all his life and a very committed pacifist, and the oncologist was using all this language about fighting. We're going to fight this. You're a fighter. And he finally had the presence of mind to say, you know what? I'm not a fighter, and I don't want to be a fighter. And all this language about battle and disease makes me feel like my body's a battleground. I really need to talk about this in some other way. Hmm. This is not helping me.
Yeah.
And so they shifted to talking about it as the journey he was on. Hmm. And just that shift from battle to journey, mm-hmm. even if you don't know where the journey is going, and it may be a journey toward death, was a restorative thing for him, and I think it can be for many people.
I think in American Christianity, we still have a tendency towards Gnosticism, mm-hmm. right? At least in the traditions that I grew up in, there was a real divide. We believe that humans were soul and spirit and body, but the soul or the spiritual was privileged over the body. I wonder if you see a connection between your work and that.
Oh, I do. I think that one of the darker legacies of the Reformation has been that tendency to bifurcate our understanding of self. And it was very helpful to me to, at one point in my life, start reading Catholic writers who have a much deeper sense of us as embodied beings mm-hmm. and our physical bodies as not only a gift, but part of who we are. So to shift from saying I have a body to I am an embodied being mm-hmm. is to embrace the body and not sort of reject it or suspect it for its carnality. And that was a long journey for me because I came from parents who certainly modeled for me a deep faith that I'm grateful for, but they came out of a generation of evangelical Christianity that suffered from that suspicion of the body, an inability to deal with sexuality or not to talk. My mother was very frank about bodily processes and so on, and she even dissected little animals with us to show it to just about the body. But so she had a clinical interest in it, but I think that it was troubling to think of the life of the body in anything, any way that I would call sacramental, or to think of the body as sacred. So that was a real journey for me, and it did involve entering into the larger Protestant Catholic dialogue and asking a question that's been very rich for me, which is what has Catholic culture preserved that Protestants lost for a period and are in the process of retrieving.
Yeah, I think, in my life it brought me back to the Episcopal Church.
Me too.
Oh, really?
Well, I didn't know that. I sneak off to the Episcopal Church every Sunday because of the Eucharist, and then I go to the Presbyterian Church because my husband is a Presbyterian pastor.
Oh, yes.
And I have a lot of respect for Reformed theology mm-hmm. and the Presbyterians, but they don't do the Eucharist in the same way.
No.
And I love Episcopal liturgy.
Yeah. Yeah, the words and the embodiment. Mm-hmm. Who were some of those Catholic writers who helped you in that journey?
Thomas Merton, for sure. Flannery O'Connor. Mm. Read everything she wrote. I just love her. I love her dark humor.
Yeah.
Dark humor is something that I think is to be reclaimed as well.
Yeah.
You know, just there's this line in Robert Bolt's The Man for All Seasons where Thomas More says, "The devil cannot bear to be mocked."
Hmm.
And it's good to mock the devil. Catholic writers. Carl Adam wrote The Spirit of Catholicism, which is now a pretty old book. I think he wrote it in the 30s. But that was very helpful to me. Hans Urs von Balthasar is the theologian I dipped into. It's copious and sometimes difficult, but he wrote a book called Herrlichkeit, which is beauty.
Hmm.
And that was another thing I had to reach into Catholicism for, was a sense of how the aesthetic is a dimension of, and needs to be a dimension of worship.
Mm-hmm.
Because for all the goodness of the low church tradition I was in, it sort of involved eschewing or suspecting the arts,
mm-hmm,
as distractions from spending time with the Word. And I recognized that as a young adult, I was thirsting for the arts. The literary arts were more permissible, but even fiction, my father really suspected fiction, always asked why I was spending so much time reading fiction. Why didn't I read nonfiction? At least it was true. And he was a very educated man and read a lot,
yeah,
mostly nonfiction.
Yeah.
But I felt as though that was a kind of impoverishment, and I didn't want to submit to that.
Hmm. Well, I want to turn in a bit of a different direction. You know, as I've watched some of the most recent political debates, I found myself thinking about caring for words in a culture of lies quite a bit. I'm not sure how to ask this, but I guess one of your strategies in caring for words in a culture of lies, one of the strategies of how to care for words is to remain in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking about that as I've watched the debates and how little we're actually in conversation with each other about these topics. We're just polarized and we're shouting. I guess I'm wondering, how can I, as just someone who's not very political and not very politically engaged, what are some ways that I can care for words in this political climate leading up to the election in a way that might be meaningful?
That's such a good question. I just want to affirm that your perception that we're polarized is so accurate, that we have lost the middle ground where civil conversation can take place and where people listen to each other. And of course, I could go on a rant about particular candidates, and I will resist the temptation to do that. But I think that one of the ways we can have conversations is to have the meta conversation, which is to say, and this is easy to do in a classroom, here are the rules. For the purposes of this hour, I want to not just hammer on the differences, but to focus on, what do we mean? And that little question, what do you mean? What do you mean when you talk about protecting our borders?
Hmm.
What does that mean? Does it mean building a wall? Does it mean having more filtering processes at the border? Does it mean reflecting on driver's licenses and documentation and children of immigrants? Just starting to unpack the slogans is a way to restore actual conversation. What do we mean by national security? That's a huge one. And really, national security is such a dangerous idea because so much totalitarianism has taken hold under that banner. So what do we mean when we talk about security? So I think the what do you mean, what do you mean, what do you mean, not in a nagging way, but to say, well, I really wonder when people use that term, what exactly we're talking about, and does that mean that we have to accept these kinds of exclusion, or we have to erect these kinds of barriers, or, and what do we really want to invest our money in? And knowing the statistics, knowing that 62% of the budget goes to the military is important. Mm-hmm. I had an exercise in writing courses for a while of just taking in one statistic at the beginning of class, putting it on the table and saying, you have 3 minutes, and you get the statistic. Like at the time, I remember one of them was 48 million Americans have no health insurance. Now I think it's down to 27 million, but that's pretty, that's a lot of people. And either you can say, if that's true, then what else is likely to be true? And play that out a little. Or, if that's true, why might it be true? So just play with one of those two questions, and then we'd unpack it for a little bit and then go on with our class. But I think that knowing a few statistics is a way to open up conversation, just to say, well, you know, the fact that in my state, schools get such a tiny part of the budget, or all schools are locally funded, which means that poor communities have poor schools. And to know some numbers stops people. And I don't think statistics give you adequate information, but they sure are a great starting point. And so many of them are shocking. People really don't know. If you say 26 million Americans are functionally illiterate, that's a showstopper.
Hmm. Yeah. So push back on the meanings of words, defining terms, know some statistics, and I also hear you saying, like, have a empathetic imagination as you consider those statistics.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wanted to say one more thing about that. I have to say that in this climate of antagonism and polarized debate, there are times to drop out of the conversation. I think that there are times to say, you know what, I don't think that we can talk about this. So you do have to check in about when you are, to what degree people are willing to enter the social contract that we call civil discourse. Because when you're with somebody who just wants to hammer you with an argument, I sort of feel as though there's a conservation of energy issue. I really don't want to spend my energy there. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I have one friend with whom I profoundly disagree. She is a friend for all kinds of good reasons. But she and I have had to decide together, actually, just not to go there. And I am political, and I think political conversation matters, and I think it's part of our mission. But I don't go there with her because I feel as though she's one of those people where I think, what do you have to forgive to get the gift?
Hmm.
And she brings a gift, and I want to receive it, but we have to not have that conversation.
Well, this book, which we've been talking about, Caring for Words and a Culture of Lies, was born out of a series of lectures you gave. Is that right? Whose idea was it to turn it into a book?
I think somebody at Erdman's, I'm trying to remember. Erdman's published it.
Yeah. So they approached you.
It was
you.
The Stone Lectures at Princeton, and I think they approached me. They have a strong connection with Princeton Seminary anyway.
Okay.
I actually don't remember.
Don't remember.
I do know that the first book of poetry, a friend who is a professor at Princeton, said, oh, you should send these poems to Erdman's. And at the time, I just thought, I don't even think they publish poetry. And I still have a feeling like I'm not really a poet. But sometimes poems come, and I'm grateful, but mostly I write prose.
Well, let's talk about that poetry a little bit. So you've written three collections of ekphrastic poems, right?
Yes.
Not everyone knows the word ekphrastic.
No, it's an awkward word. But it's basically any art form that is responding to another art, work of art.
So you have three books of poems that respond to paintings, right?
Yes, and then I have another book of poems that are just poems.
Okay. We have Van Gogh and Rembrandt and who's the third?
Vermeer.
Vermeer. Well, I have your book of poems responding to Van Gogh's paintings. It's called The Color of Light. And I wonder if you would just choose one or two of your favorites and describe the painting and then read the poem for us.
Yeah. Well, this one was fun to write. If you know a little bit about Van Gogh, you know that his father was a Protestant pastor.
And he
wanted to be a missionary, and he really had a heart for things of the Spirit. He, like so many people, struggled with the church, but I don't think he ever lost his sense of the sacred and his orientation toward worship. I've been moved by his self-portraits, of which he did many. Artists do self-portraits partly because the model is cheap. And I was struck when I visited the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam with how, when you look closely at them, the variegation of color in skin tones and in the air around them is so interesting. Mm-hmm. One feature of Van Gogh that I connect to his spirituality is how solid, liquid, and gas seem to keep in exchanging. There aren't clear lines between what is solid and what is air.
Mm-hmm.
And so the air really seems thick with color and presence, and the sun is dense, but objects seem as though they're just evaporating. So actually, I think I'll read one about a lesser-known painting called The Olive Trees. It goes to that point. It's a painting of olive trees where their shadows look as solid as the trees. And there's this radiant, solid sun that you wonder why it stays up there, because it looks so heavy, with lots of sunlight that has texture to it. Very dry landscape, and I'm so acutely conscious of drought these days in California that this one looks really familiar. This is called The Olive Trees. If the sun came closer, everything would burn. Each tree is an act of courage, holding its own, making peace with the heat and dry ground, forbearing while mountains not yet made low rise like monuments to what may be born. God, who burned in bush and pillar, watches still from behind a veil of fire, burns away and scatters in harsh and unavoidable blessing. Under its heat, the small fruit grow, are plucked and brought to vinegar and salt. Immolation brings forth. Taste and see. I think, just as I said earlier today, that every writer teaches us something about how to read. I think every visual artist teaches us something about how to see. There's another one about trees. I'm going to read another one. This is about cypresses. And, of course, he painted a number of cypresses. They're all over the French landscape. And again, it's a tree rising into air that looks as dense and with mass as the tree itself. And the tree has all kinds of movement in it. So you really get the sense that the objects on the landscape have life and have stories, and they're happening. They're verbs, they're not nouns. This is about the cypresses. Everything moves upward, earth into water, air, and finally fire that burns up, up, energy so refined that it baffles the bounding senses. What must it be to see the urgency of the cypress and how the very field strains higher, envying the clouds, loving the early moon, roots tingling in earth that will not let them go? But the form of this life is a calling and a command. Accept it all, the cells, the helix, the twist and spin of whorled bark, the partial death, yellow to brown. Even clouds consent for a while to curl and thicken, and the moon wanes into a dense ridge, distilled before it dies. These are the terms the lilies get. They toil not, but they spin. They spin.
You mentioned, as you introduced those poems about trees, the drought in California.
Right.
And I know that caring for the environment is another passion of yours, right?
Yeah.
So I wonder how caring for words and caring for the world, the earth, are connected.
Well, I love that question. I do teach a course, or have taught a course, called Attitudes Toward the Environment in American Writing. And as you were saying about Protestant attitudes toward the body, there is a carryover into the way we treat the earth. That, in fact, I have had students from particular bandwidths of Christian culture who basically say environmentalism is a leftist agenda. It's not a spiritual agenda. It's all going to burn. And it's so opposite to the sense that God gave it to us to be his stewards, and that there will be a new heaven and a new earth, mm-hmm. and that the earth is, that caring for the earth is a sacred task. So I think the analogy between caring for language and caring for the earth and its resources is very close. I also think it's a matter of learning to notice. As I was saying in my talk today, part of the training in an English class is to notice what's lying on the page and how it works. And so to notice process, to notice what happens when the manure from the CAFOs, these factory farms, goes into big pools that then leach into the soil and carry antibiotics and hormones. To really get to that level of understanding process is to have a very different relationship to food, to animals, to earth. And it's horrifying. But I have encountered perfectly intelligent, thoughtful people who basically say, you know what, I just don't want to hear about it. I just want to eat my steak. And I don't have much respect for that. I just think if we're going to enjoy the benefits of anything, then we need to know where they come from. Mm-hmm. I also think that we don't have, I absolutely believe that climate change is happening and that the deniers have a short-term agenda that is really going to damage all of us. One of the writers I've been pushing lately is Naomi Klein, who's a Canadian economist who has written several powerful books, and her most recent is called This Changes Everything. And she and Bill McKibben and Wendell Berry and others who are prophetic voices saying we have an opportunity here to help the paradigm shift happen. And it's a pretty much a life or death choice. It may be that human life will survive, but even the rising generation of students who are in college now are going to have to face things that we never did. And certainly my grandchildren are going to get a world in which they have to inhabit on completely different terms. So I do think that caring for it is a matter of educating ourselves and each other and being willing to look at some very hard things. I do dinner and documentary nights with students periodically, and that's a way to get a lot of information without sitting down with copious books. But you do run into the overwhelm factor. And one of my daughters said to me once, Mom, you have a bigger appetite for bad news than anybody I know. But I think there have to be people who are willing to sit with the bad news and mm-hmm. spell it out and think about it and lament it and then get up and do the thing you can do, knowing you're not Jesus and you're not going to save the world yourself, mm-hmm. but to be faithful about practices and willing to know is a big piece of the mm-hmm. challenge.
Yeah. Well, we have talked about a lot of heavy things today. And so let's end on a lighter note.
Sure.
One of our students wanted me to ask you, what are some words that are really flavorful to you right now?
Let's see. Oh, what a fun assignment. I had a good time doing that collection called Word Tastings, where I asked people to pick a word.
Mm-hmm.
And my two words were dwelling, which I love, and grace. I do love participles like dwelling because they have that double-edged character of being both nouns and verbs.
Mm-hmm.
And I like nouns that verge into verbs.
Yeah. So you're okay with a fluidity to language?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Language is fluid. Yeah. And I think caring for language doesn't at all mean protecting it from change. Mm-hmm. Because it does evolve just as natural organisms evolve. But there's a difference between evolving and being corrupted or manipulated, just mm-hmm. as there's a difference between natural extinction of species and the kind of forced extinction of thousands of species that we're witnessing now.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I do gravitate to bad news.
There we go.
Yeah, here we go. So, flavorful words. Lately, I have somehow heard myself saying the word astute a lot. There are particular people whose quality of intelligence I think of as astute. And I was talking with the woman earlier about my essay on the word felicity and how it is a particular kind of happiness that we need a word for. And I think astute is a particular kind of intelligence that to me has to do with a willingness to pause and notice and be precise and pay attention and spend time on. And so I think that that's come into my consciousness because of particular people who embody it for me. I also have found myself remembering words that my grandparents used, my Virginia, North Carolina grandparents, and have recognized in various encounters how much of their language I still carry after all these words. It's like part of the genetic code after all these years. But I love the way my grandmother used the word visiting. She kind of left the I out. But, well, she came over and we did a little visiting. And to visit is also a word that has a rich heritage to it, not just to drop in on, not just to check in with. I use the word check in a lot. Oh, it's great to see you. Let's check in later. And that's okay. But it's sort of quippy and quick and, you know, we're not going to have a time for a real visit, but let's have coffee. But visiting or visiting is... It expresses an intention to sit down and lay other things aside and look each other in the eye and have a conversation and feast on it. And she was capable of that. And so witnessing that kind of visit as a child has at least kept a gold standard for me in what visits need to be, even though a lot of my visits are checking in.
It's a great Southern word and a great Southern practice, really.
It is.
Well, it has been a joy to visit with you and hear your astute observations morning.
Nicely done.
Thanks.
Thank you. My pleasure. Really such a pleasure to be here.
Relief is a production of Relief Publications. Our production engineers are Alex Negron and Nico Hayes, and our theme music is by Sun and Air. You can listen to more of their music at sunandairmusic.com. That's sunandairmusic.com. We'd like to thank Taylor University and WTUR. And of course, you can find more about us on the web at reliefjournal.com. Thank you for listening.